All right. If you guys have a Bible, if you'll open to Psalm chapter 50. No. We just had that conversation back there in the media room. Psalm 24, if you will, please. And you'll see why I said Psalm 50 as we get into this. I'm sorry for the temperature in this place. It's extremely cold, and I don't know, the heaters just don't seem to keep up with it. But that's the beauty of the system, because the air conditioners don't keep up with it in the summertime. So at least we're consistent, if nothing else. Psalm 24 is a psalm of David. And Jewish rabbinical tradition says that this psalm was written in the time when the Ark was coming back to Jerusalem. If you don't know the story of that, it's found in, well, both in 1 Samuel chapter 6 and 2 Samuel chapter 6. Originally, when the Ark was carried away from Israel, it was during the reign of Saul, when the Philistines had come in and Saul was going to go up to attack them. And in his hubris, he assumed that God was going to be with them, and he took the Ark out with them as a good luck charm. And the Philistines went ahead and just destroyed them and took their Ark and went in and destroyed Shiloh. We think they may have destroyed the tabernacle at that time, but we don't know for sure on that. And so they had the Ark there in Philistia in one of their temples, in the temple to Dagon, for a period of time, but it just kept making such a mess in the place, they didn't want to keep it anymore. In other words, their idol kept falling over every time that they'd turn their backs. And, you know, they'd look over at the Ark, and the Ark is just whistling like that. And so they'd put the idol back up, and they'd walk away, and they come back, and it's down again. And this time the hands are gone. Finally said, look, this is way too much maintenance. You know, it's like adopting a cat, and it's peeing everywhere. So they said, we're getting rid of this thing, and they put it on a cart, and they send it back to Israel. And the first village that it came to in Israel, you know, the villagers there, because it was during the time of the judges, and Israel was quite backslidden in their understanding of their heritage and who they were. So the villagers, when the Ark came up there, they kind of had an idea of what it was. And so they're just looking at it and exploring it and stuff. And suddenly a plague breaks out there. And people are dying left and right. And so they send a query out saying, you know, what do we do with this thing? This is a real mess. And so they put it off in another guy's house nearby there, the foot of a hill. And it stayed there for years and years and years, almost to the point where you'd think that Israel had kind of forgotten about it, until when David became king, he determined it was time to go and get that ark and bring it back up to Jerusalem. And so years after the fact, after it had been taken away from the Israelites, it was coming back into Israel. And so it could be that this psalm is written during that time, or was written for that occasion. It became a liturgical psalm, a psalm that was sung by Israel, oftentimes sung as the pilgrims would be coming into Jerusalem for the feast days. And it's often read in connection with Palm Sunday, because it has such a deep correlation with Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem during his final week of his earthly ministry. So it begins here in verses 1 and 2, setting the stage. It says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. So he starts right off here saying the earth is the Lord's. You know, that's to say that the world belongs to God, or it's almost got a religious sentiment to it when we say that just offhandedly. The earth is the Lord's, you know, the whole world's in his hands, and that kind of idea. But this is the setup to God's grandeur. This is to remind us exactly who's in charge around here, who it is that everyone will ultimately answer to, the one who's in charge of everything. And you think about the statement, just an offhanded statement like this, but knowing what we know now, when we consider the millions of galaxies, the millions of stars that are out there, and the multitude of galaxies that are in this universe, and here we've got this one little solar system, which is one little star in the middle of all of these galaxies, and in this galaxy called the Milky Way. One little star in the middle of that, and it has all these planets rotating around it, and that ends up being our little solar system, and right in the middle of all of these little planets, there is one planet that's unique among all of those other planets in that it can sustain carbon-based life forms. And Psalm 24 tells us that that planet belongs to the Lord. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean that just that planet belongs to the Lord, and, you know, the rest of them are up for grabs, but the idea is that planet, what's going on there is of unique importance and something that the Lord, that God sees the necessity to reiterate and establish that he is the owner of it all. I mean, from the mountains to the oceans to the microbes and the atoms, all of it is what belongs to God. It's all his. To get a concept of that, I love the way the message word Psalm 50. Can you put Psalm 50 up there on the screen for me? One part of this is he says, every creature in the forest is mine. The wild animals on all the mountains. I know every mountain bird by name. The scampering field mice are my friends. If I get hungry, do you think I'd tell you? All creation and its bounty are mine. This is God. This is the God that we're dealing with. This is the God who owns it all, who manages it all. It all belongs to him. Why is there this declaration of ownership here then? Why is this necessary? If he owns it all, why does he need to announce that he owns it all? Well, because this is where man is. God has to reassert his ownership here because of what's happened here, because of what's happened in this place. The fall and the introduction of sin onto this planet, into this system that we live in, challenges God's ownership on a regular basis. That's the whole concept. His ownership of it all is challenged regularly. So God has to reassert and remind us he's the owner. He owns it all. He's the one who made it all. It's an important truth for us to remember because when we look around at this planet, when we look around at the pain and the suffering, when we look around at all of the things that can go wrong here, there can be a temptation at times to feel like we've been abandoned, to feel like, you know, maybe God doesn't own this anymore. Maybe everything's just run amok and he's busy off somewhere else. So this sort of a reassertion of his ownership is really important. It's a vital kind of thing because it reminds us that the earth is the Lord's. He's not going to let this ruination last forever. He's not going to let this go on this way. This belongs to him. So it reminds us to have hope because help is on the way. This place belongs to him and he's coming back to put things right, to reestablish his original intended order. And it also reminds us as his followers, as the human race that he's made, that we're stewards of this place. We're set here to mind what belongs to him. And it's a real temptation for us, especially as consumer Americans, to claim ownership to all kinds of things. And it's something important for us to remember that we're merely stewards. All of these things that we attribute as our belongings are no such thing. There is no such thing as owning things when everything belongs to God. That we're just simply taking care of. We're stewarding those things that have been provided to us by God, but it's not in any kind of a situation where we could call ourselves the owners of anything. We never want to mistake who the owner is, of all things. When it comes to the things that we possess, the things that we have, comes to, you know, what resources we have. You know, people have said to me before, well, I'm so glad, you know, you never talk about tithing. I'm so glad you're not into tithing. It's just nice to know that, you know, this is all mine and God doesn't want what's mine. And well, you know, and it's odd, but somebody actually said that to me, and I don't think they're here tonight, but I mean, the point is we don't want to get a misunderstanding of that. When we say that sort of thing, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying we have a license to be greedy. Everything that we have belongs to God. It's all his. And he's the one who directs it. Well, the reason I don't, you know, I had another person one time who was an adamant tither said, well, you know, but it's the best deal you could possibly get because you get for the first 10%. I mean, God takes the first 10% and you get everything else. Everything else is yours to keep. And that's an absurd kind of concept. The earth is the Lord's. All of it belongs to him. We're simply stewards. We're just managing what it is that he's put us in charge of. And we keep that in mind in the lives that we live. But we also want to remember that when he talks about the earth as being the Lord's, it also means the nations that we live in, You know, that we're stewards of this planet and also its nations. That's what he's talking about when he said he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. The concept behind that is the idea of borders, the boundaries between nations. And that's what he's saying, is that all of the various nations, it's a declaration that not only is Israel God's, not only, you know, clearly Israel is God's, he's the one who made them and provided a destiny for them, but they all ultimately belong to God. He's ultimately the one who's calling the shots on all of these things, everything. You know, every leader that rises up, every leader that goes down, happens by God's design and God's purpose. We want to remember that in our country, especially as when it comes to people who get voted into office and all. We got to remember who it is that put them there and remember to honor them because of that. But the other thing is it means that we can't even say that our own lives belong to us, because he says that the earth is the Lord's and all those who dwell therein, which means that our very lives belong to God. And then, you know, it's going to determine, it's our choices are going to determine whether we live that out. But the reality is God lays claim on everything he made. Every life that he created is his. It belongs to him. So even with our own lives, we're just stewards. Do we use it for our own self gain, our own selfish worldview and self will, or do we submit our lives to him, every aspect of our lives, from our hearts to our souls, to our minds, to our strength? Do we yield that to him for his purposes and for his glory? Well, he goes on then as he's establishing that. God's in charge. He's the one who's transcendent. He's above it all. He made the whole thing. Everyone will be answerable to him. And so then it says here in verse 3, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who doesn't lift up his soul to what is false and doesn't swear deceitfully, he'll receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. Well, so we begin by establishing the transcendency and the rule of God. He's the one in charge of it all. He's in control of it all. So the question that naturally arises from that, we think about this God who is transcendent, which means he exceeds, far exceeds. He's even beyond the measure of what we understand or could hope to grasp when it comes to righteousness or power or understanding. So the question that arises from that, we establish that he's great, then who can be with him? Who gets to dwell with this kind of a God? Who gets to, you know, when he says to ascend the holy hill or to stand in the holy place, the idea is moving towards God and dwelling with God. And he's using the imagery of the tabernacle at that point. It's a Psalm of David, so it's pre-temple days. But using the imagery of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was that tangible representation of God's presence on this earth. That's what that was all about. And he's saying in that, you know, if we consider that he's bringing the ark in, if this is when that was written, if he's bringing the ark in, the idea is then who's going to be able to hang out there with God? I mean, God is the transcendent one. He's the all-powerful one. We all are going to have to answer to him. Well, who gets to be on God's side? Who is it that's going to be on his team if his team's the one that's going to win the big game? And as we read his answers on this, because that's, he poses this question and then he answers it. More than likely, this would have been done as a responsive reading, a liturgy. Somebody would have spoken one part of it and then the answer would come back from another group of singers. But, you know, the answer that he gives is something that we've got to read first from David's perspective on it and then try to understand it from a New Testament perspective, because the New Testament certainly brings a larger enlightenment to the whole thing. The answer that David provides is conditional. And when you think of it, it's sort of like climbing a mountain. You know, maybe you feel like you're getting close to the top or something, and all of a sudden, all of the various passes lead up to just a sheer rock face. There's nothing there's no foothold, there's no possible way of being able to scale that. It's completely unclimbable, it's completely out of reach. That's the sense that comes across in what David's describing here. You know, who's going to be able to do this? Well, somebody who's got clean hands and a pure heart, which speaks of a person's outward behavior, the clean hands, meaning that the way he behaves, the way he treats his fellow man is completely upright, and a pure heart. And the idea behind that is somebody whose motives are in harmony with God's values and character. Somebody who's in step with what God's desiring, whose outward actions and inward motives are completely harmonious and not only with each other, but with God's plan and purpose, so that, you know, we only think on those things that we would do, and we only do those things that are right. That's the concept behind what he's saying here. His inner motives, outward actions altogether, whose heart is set solely on doing God's will, and who's honest in all of his interactions with his fellow human being. Oh, that's all? Well, that's easy. That's great. Awesome. See, if this was written, because you read something like that and right away, I mean, well, probably not you guys because you're good people, but for me, you're right away thinking, man, who measures up to that? I mean, who could possibly measure up to that? And I'm thinking that if David was writing this in the context of the ark coming back into Jerusalem, then that could provide us a little bit of an insight as to what it is that he's describing here in this. I mean, it would be interesting because that question, who can ascend the hill of the Lord, who can dwell with God, that question actually came up in 1 Samuel chapter 6. Remember the village I was telling you about that they took the ark to first? That was the question they asked when everybody was dropping dead around that crazy box. They said, who can dwell with this thing? What do we have to do? Who do we have to be able to be with this sort of thing? It's possible that David's hearkening back to that concept that, you know, this is no easy task. This is no simple thing when we talk about dwelling with this God who is transcendent the way he is. This is an important question to ask. Who can dwell with this thing? No one was worthy to be able to get near that ark without going through quite a bit of ritual purification and offering the right sacrifices. No one was able to just go, you know, there've been movies before that I've seen where they've shown, you know, David just walking into the Holy of Holies and plopping down and chatting with the ark, you know, and that's just obscene. It is obscene. It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous because that sort of thing didn't happen. You couldn't do that. There was a lot that was required and only the right people were allowed to get into the Holy of Holies. Otherwise it was cut off from everybody else. It was the Levites and the priests who were allowed to have any kind of interaction with it, and only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies at certain times of the year with the right sacrifices after going through the right purification processes. David's bringing this box into Jerusalem, and he's asking this question. Who's going to be able to hang out with this box we got here? Who's going to be able to hang out with this God who's dwelling here with us, who's coming in, and his manifest presence is going to be here, sitting in the middle of this city. I think this is interesting. David doesn't point to the ritual purification processes that the priest goes through in his song here. Now I realize maybe it's because it didn't rhyme well or didn't go with the rhythm or whatever, but he doesn't point to that. He doesn't say he's got to make sure that he goes through this, this, and this in order to do it. No, he points towards those moral characteristics that would be necessarily inherent in the individual who's going to be able to hang out with this ark of God, this manifest presence of God. He's talking about this moral character trait that would have to accompany somebody who's going to be able to spend time and dwell with the presence of God this way. And it could very well be that David is trying to assert in this that nobody's been able to do that yet. Nobody's done this. Nobody can do this. Nobody can just dwell with this God. Nobody at this point has been able to have clean hands and a pure heart to be able to do this. We've got to go through the purification processes. We've got to offer the right sacrifices because we haven't been able to do it. And then he considers the blessing that would accompany it, a people who would be able to do that. He talks about how they'd know the righteousness of God and his salvation, that would characterize the kind of people that could do that. And it could very well be that he's forecasting a future, a hope. He's saying to Israel as he's bringing this ark back in, this is what we've got to consider. God's manifest presence is going to be here with us. So that changes everything. That changes the way we go about living our lives. That changes how we understand our lives or our city or our country, our nation, our calling. All of this changes because God's presence is going to be here. And that's what he's forecasting, that this generation that's going to be involved in this, we got to see these changes take place. We've got to see a future generation that can attain to that sort of state of purity of motive and purity of action and honesty in interaction with this fellow man. And of course, we read all of this and then we look at it from the vantage point of the New Testament. I'm just proposing what David may have meant. I don't know for sure, but I mean, proposing what David may have meant by those statements. But then we step back and we look at what David says here in light of the Gospels, in light of what we know about Christ. And man, we know who it is that fits this description. We know who it is who actually can fulfill exactly what David was talking about. The only one who could qualify for these conditions was Jesus Christ, is Jesus Christ. And that's the significance of the gospel, that Jesus entered into God's presence as a human being. That's something we never want to forget about who Jesus is. He's fully God and fully man. He is the God-man. He is fully human, a human being, entered into God's presence, having no spot or wrinkle, having no sin on his record, having a clean hands and a pure heart, and in honesty dealing with his fellow man. All of these things that were mentioned here. And when he was sacrificed for our sins, he enters into God's presence in a unique way, in a way that actually ushers us into God's presence as well. So that's the whole thing that happened. Remember when Jesus died on the cross, the Holy of Holies in the temple, the earth shook. The Holy of Holies was cordoned off with a thick, heavy curtain that was torn from the top to the bottom, symbolizing that separation between God and man, that separation that kept us safe from God. It was never about trying to keep God safe from man or that we would sully him somehow. It was trying to keep us safe from God because of our fallen state. We couldn't get that close to him. But because of Jesus' life, his perfect life, his sacrifice and death on our behalf and subsequent resurrection, that veil was torn away. Now there's no separation between us and God. All of us are capable of dwelling with God. And that's what, let me put Hebrews 10 up on the screen, read to you what it says there. Hebrews 10 verses 19, it says, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let's draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." In other words, we are that generation that David was looking towards. We are that generation. We who have believed on Jesus, and all of those in this great family of God who've believed on him, we're the ones who fulfill what David was forecasting there, was longing for, looking for. Oh, if there was a people who could live right, who could have this right standing with God and dwell with him, what a joy that would be. They would have God's righteousness. They would know salvation. And that's exactly what God provided for us. It's not a matter of us being able to attain to this. It's not a matter of us being able to be righteous enough to do this. Jesus was the righteous one who went in before us and then opened wide the gates to let us in as well, and allows us to live there and dwell with him. We're the ones who have Jesus' righteousness attributed to us so that we can dwell with God. We don't have to go through any sort we don't have to jump through any hoops. We don't have to go through any program to try to get to him. Jesus opened the way. And so in any moment, at any time, God is available to us, and we enter into a place that was at one time kept away from us. And this isn't, you know, I'm saying all this, I don't want to disarm the gravity of what David's getting across there, because we don't want to just say, see, so nobody's going to have clean hands, nobody's going to have a good heart, it's all Jesus, he's going to do it for us, and now we get to go in. Well, it is all Jesus, and he's the one who did it for us, but those verses there, verses 3 to 6, remind us about God's values. His values that he looks for in the people that he redeems. His righteousness is now imputed to us, which means that our hearts have changed, which means it'll be reflected in the way that we live our lives. So we don't want to just brush past this and say, whew, got off the hook on that. But like, we're warned that faith without works is dead. The idea is a confession of belief in Jesus that doesn't have some evidence somewhere in our lives that our lives are coming into harmony with God's values, then that makes our confession dubious. We can say what we want all day long, but in the final analysis, are we really in God's presence? If our lives are completely the same as they were before, if there's no change, if our values don't change and come into harmony with him. See, it's not a matter of having to do these things or live this way in order to get into God's presence. It's that we are invited into God's presence, and because we're in God's presence, then these things begin to change. Then the way we live begins to reflect something different, because we dwell with him, right? Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying in that? Okay. All right, moving on. Verses 7 to 10. It says, then all of a sudden the song changes, and we see a different kind of a picture here. Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who's this King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Now, I'm putting the inflection in there. I have no idea if that would be the right way to read that or not. But the concept, this last section, again, is like a responsive reading. And we've got this pattern that develops here. This command is given. A command is given. A question is posed. The answer to the question is provided, and the command is reiterated, and the question is reiterated, and the command or the answer is given again. So, I mean, like, it's like I said, it's like a repeating pattern. The call goes out to open the gates. Now, we would assume that this is talking about the gates of Jerusalem. Jerusalem surrounded around by a strong wall. All ancient cities were. They had the massive main gates through which most of your commerce would come in and out. And so those would be guarded carefully so that you don't just let anybody in or enemies in. And so if this is written for the time when the ark is coming back to Jerusalem, we've got David and the priests and all of those in this procession with the ark coming up to the gates of Israel, and the call goes out, open up the gates. It's time to open them up because the King of glory is here. Speaking about God's manifest presence in that form of that ark. And so the answer, comes back, actually, before we get to that, we think about the concept of this, that the king, the Israel's king, is coming back into the city. If we use that ark as an example or an emblem of God's manifest presence there, and we know that Jesus actually fulfilled this quite well, as he came into Jerusalem. That's why this is oftentimes associated with Palm Sunday, because he came into Jerusalem. Zechariah forecast that he was going to come to them humbly, riding on a donkey. And of course, Jesus did that and fulfilled that. The King of glory came to them, but not in a way that they were anticipating, not in with all the accoutrements that they were expecting. And something like this is going to happen again. We know, as best as we can tell, based on all of the scenarios of how this thing is going to wrap up, based on the scriptures that deal with that of end time prophecy, that Jesus is going to come back to Israel. He's going to come back to Jerusalem. When he returns, he's coming there to that city. So he will, in that time, he's going to come in glory. It's going to be a far cry from his first appearance. It's going to be not quite as humbly. It's going to be quite powerful and glorious as he reveals himself in his second coming. And so there's a historic way in which this was fulfilled. There's a future fulfillment. And it's also something that continues to be fulfilled on a regular basis in the lives of those who've believed on Jesus, in the lives of those of us who've embraced him as king and consider ourselves to be part of God's kingdom, who belong to God. as we look at the way this psalm is written, we can kind of see that there's a little bit of a struggle with this idea that the king is coming in. Because the call goes out, open up the gates, the King of Glory is here. And the question comes back, what King of Glory? What are you talking about? What do you mean? A king? And I have King of Glory on my list here, not under K anyway. And that's our struggle today. We've got this same kind of thing going on, where when we believed on Jesus, this is the launching point of the King of Glory coming into our lives, coming in to take over, taking over every aspect of our lives. And we, just like Jerusalem, have really strong walls built around a lot of areas of our lives. Strong walls that we, keep in reserve a lot of areas of our own self-will, a lot of areas of ego, and things that we think are really, really important, things that we feel are justified in defending. And the call goes out on a regular basis. Now open up these gates, Rob. Open them up so the King of Glory can come in. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I don't know about the King of Glory coming in here. We kind of have plans for this area of our life. And the call goes out again. Open up those gates. The King of Glory is going to come in. See, the thing is we operate under the faulty notion that we've got to keep those walls up. We've got to keep certain areas defended in our lives, reserved back away from the Lord because, well, we want to keep those things safe. Because his track record is he comes in, as we said before in the Gospel of Luke, with a pitchfork, throwing everything in the air and driving us a little bit crazy in the process, trying to figure out what it is that he thinks he's doing with all these precious things of our lives. And yet, we don't even realize that without the King of Glory, without that ark inside Jerusalem, she was no more protected than any other nation out there. It was that ark. It was God's manifest presence coming in to those walls that made the difference, that made Israel stand out, that made her safer than any other place as she dwelt with God. And that's the concept for us, that all these areas in our lives that we think are so important that we want to try to maintain and preserve for ourselves, we're not preserving at all. We're actually ruining in the process. It's not until we open up those gates, swing them wide open, yield those things and surrender those various aspects of our lives, our hopes, our dreams, surrender those to God. That's when they become safe, which is exactly what Jesus was trying to get across to us when he said, whoever's going to find his life is going to lose it. And whoever will lose his life finds it. And it sounds like one of those weird little, it sounds like something the Karate Kid's master would say or something, weird little things that don't, little contradictions. And yet there's such a deep meaning to the whole thing. For as long as we're trying to carve out life for ourselves or establish ourselves or establish something that we want to see preserved, we're going to be as unfulfilled as any human being on this planet. We're never going to know the satisfaction that we're so deeply craving. But when we yield that to him, we surrender that to him, we say, there you go, God, you take it, it's yours. And if you take it in ways that I didn't anticipate or I didn't want to go, well, I will yield to you and I'll serve you in it. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in this place of peace and satisfaction and fulfillment that we never thought possible to obtain. And that's all because the King of Glory has come in. That's the whole idea behind that. So they bring back this answer, of course. The King of Glory is the Lord. He's strong and powerful. He's described like a champion who comes in from a battle, who's won the victory. And, of course, that's a picture of the risen Christ as well. That Jesus went out, when he came in his earthly ministry, went out and confronted our enemy. We just talked about that last week in the Gospel of Luke. The whole temptation on the wilderness was not Jesus being dragged into something that he was a victim in. This was Jesus being led by the Spirit to go out and face his enemy, face the very one that he was going to end up defeating. Jesus, in his resurrection, conquered the last enemy that mankind had to fear, and that is death. He took care of him. He did a clothesline elbow drop on him and then kicked him out of the ring. And it was done. He was the champion. He's the one who won that victory for us for all time. So these pictures of God as the champion returned from battle to rule his kingdom is a good way to actually understand the Christian life. instead of looking at the Christian life as this series of behavior modifications that I've got to undertake and try to do to make, you know, the pastor happy or the people around me happy or whatever, we need to understand our lives as Christians as citizens of the Hero King, citizens who do the bidding of the King who is still alive, who lives to this day, who directs and guides the operations of his church, of the ministry, of the embodiment of the kingdom of God here on this earth. To understand our lives from that perspective, it takes it into a completely different realm. We're serving the King. We're doing something really important. We're doing something world-changing in all of the things that we do for the kingdom, in all the ways in which we demonstrate his love and go outside of our own self-will to be able to demonstrate that sacrificial love that he demonstrated to this world. That's the concept of the Christian life. So the question again, you know, who's this King of Glory you were saying? And I love it that it just keeps getting repeated. And of course, obviously, it's for the sake of liturgy, I'm sure. But in some ways, I keep thinking that there's kind of a picture of me in that because I'm kind of stupid and slow on these things. And I keep having to go through this same process. Open up the gates there, Rob. Jesus wants to come in and take care of this. No, who? What? We're going to do what now? Wait a minute. Okay, we've done this about 50 times now. Let's try it again. Open up the gates, Rob. Who's this King of Glory? And that's the thing, you know, this kind of a picture of us as human beings. But also, in a liturgical sense, in the Hebrew, to repeat something is to provide emphasis to it. So the idea is, this is important. This is a very important aspect of this. Your understanding of, you know, from David's perspective, he's telling Israel, your understanding of yourself, your understanding of who you are, your purpose, your reason for being is going to be known as you allow this King of Glory in, as we allow this to come back into our city walls and we establish our identities on that. And the same is true with us. If we're looking for the answers are found in that the hope and the satisfaction, the fulfillment that we're looking for, that we're craving so much, is going to be known as we yield every aspect of our lives, take the risk, employ the discipline necessary to yield every aspect of our lives to that King of Glory. So we can be settled on this. This, the whole idea is emphasized because this is a truth that we can found our lives and our identities on. The earth is the Lord's. Everything belongs to him. Everyone will answer to him one way or the other. There's no getting around it. The earth is the Lord's. Everyone in it belongs to him. And so, if there's an answering that's going to be made, then how do we get on the right side of this one that we answer to? Well, with clean hands and a pure heart, and that comes through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and believing on him as we yield to him. As we yield to him in faith that he's our Savior, then we also yield our lives to him day by day. Let the King of Glory come in and establish us and heal us and make us into the people that he intended us to be. Right on? Yes, sir.
Can